After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
What you just said is pivotal. How can I understand what you said other than as what it would mean if I had said it?
That's right. How can I release you from my projections?
Wow.
It's so earthy and simple in a way.
Yeah.
It's very clear. It's not like I have to have great spiritual attainment in order to release you from my projections. Well, that would be great too. But I could actually start with these steps.
Yeah.
In this diagram.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your podkick and monologist. All of us here at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are happy that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guide, senior Buddhist teacher, musician, and entrepreneur David Nichtern discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with our guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And in this episode, we are fortunate to have New York Times bestselling author, Buddhist teacher, practitioner of the Enneagram, and longtime friend of David's, Susan Piver. In this discussion, the warmth of David and Susan's friendship is on full display. They begin by discussing Susan's relationship with the Enneagram, her journey writing the book, and cover some Enneagram basics. Then, they launch into a rich conversation on how to relate compassionately with those around us based on these principles, which the poll quote up top foreshadows. And now, some brief biographical info on Susan to set the table, and then on with the show. Susan Piver is the New York Times best-selling author of many books, including the award-winning How Not to Be Afraid of Your Own Life, The Wisdom of a Broken Heart, Start Here Now, An Open-Hearted Guide to the Path and Practice of Meditation, and The Four Noble Truths of Love, Buddhist Wisdom for Modern Relationships. Piver has been a practicing Buddhist since 1993 and graduated from a Buddhist seminary in 2004. She is an internationally acclaimed meditation teacher, known for her ability to translate ancient practices into modern life. Her work has been featured on The Oprah Show, Today, CNN, and in The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and others. In 2013, she launched The Open Heart Project, the largest virtual mindfulness community in the world with 20,000 members. Susan has a new book available now entitled The Buddhist Enneagram, The 9 Paths to Warriorship. You can get it wherever books are sold. However, we encourage you to head over to her website, openheartproject.com, and pick up a book as directly as you can. All right, thank you for listening to the intro, and now on with the show. Here is David Nickturn and Susan Piver in discussion.
Well, as I live and breathe, and it's actually hard to do one without the other, welcome back to the marvelous, wonderful, dear, deep, old friend and frequenter of the Dharma Moon community and the podcast of Creativity, Spirituality, and Making the Buck. Let's have a big round of applause for Ms. Susan Piver, everybody, from the Open Heart Project.
I'm so happy to be here. And okay. Of course, I'm always happy to see you. And
yeah.
Any touch point I have with the Dharma Moon world is always makes me happy.
Yeah. Let's just let everybody know that, we'll be talking to each other, but they can be listening in at the same time.
Perfect.
Okay. And in particular, because you and I have talked about everything over many years, so there's probably not a topic that's, untouched, but there's this interesting thing with you and numbers that, if you remember, I kind of observed at one point. I literally saw you. We were talking, just hanging out one evening, and I saw numbers swirling around you in my sort of mind's eye. I said, "What's that, Susan?" And then I realized it was this connection you have to the Enneagram. And now you're writing a book about this. It's been like your sort of secret sauce, I think, in a way. And you're not only writing a book about it, but you're connecting it with your Buddhist teaching and studies. So it's called the Buddhist Enneagram, right?
All true, yes.
Am I saying it right?
Yes, you are.
Or is it Enneagram?
Enneagram. How did you say it?
Enneagram.
I don't think it's Enneagram. It's Enneagram. Okay.
Enneagram. So accent on the first syllable. The Buddhist Enneagram. So what the heck is that? Because I'm still trying to sort out, did anybody ever put those two things together before?
Well, yes, I'm still trying to sort it out too. And as far as I know, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. But not from a tantric perspective.
Oh.
So there has been writing in the past about different forms of spirituality. Can a cat be on the podcast?
They have to sign a release, but that'll be okay. Yeah.
They sign the release by showing you their butt. okay, well done. Well done.
Can we say butt on a podcast? Yeah. Okay.
Kitty, thank you.
Here's the real question. Can we not say butt on a podcast? That's what you and I would have to figure out, how to not do that. So, all right. So
people have written about the Enneagram with some sense of overlap in the Hindu world, perhaps. In the Sufi world, certainly.
Right.
Very much so in the Christian world in the last decade or so.
Okay.
But as far as I know, the Buddhist world, no. And the Vajrayana world, definitely no.
Okay. So in a nutshell, that's the title of my autobiography, My Life in a Nutshell. What do you think?
I like it.
I was also working on In One Era and Out the Other.
Good too.
Yeah. In a nutshell, for people who may not be familiar with the Enneagram.
Yeah.
What is it?
Yes. Good question. So Ennea, E-N-N-E-A, is the Greek prefix for 9.
Oh.
And the system posits 9 ways of being, sometimes called 9 personality types. But it's so much more vast than personality types like the 5 Buddha families.
Right.
You would never say these are 5 personality types, but there are personalities that go along with them, personality traits,
okay.
Anger, or pride, and so on.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So the Enneagram, too, personality traits go along with them. And you can stop there. You can certainly stop there.
So it could be just a schema for understanding how people manifest.
Yeah, from a psychological perspective.
Like Myers-Briggs or something like that.
Exactly like Myers-Briggs.
Okay. But what is it to you, though? It's something more than that to you.
Yeah, it is to me what much of our Buddhist practice also is to me, and I know to you as well, which is it describes a way to transform poison into medicine.
Oh.
It's transformational. It's magical. It's mysterious, and it like the five Buddha families, a form of wisdom in Tibetan tradition, the poison and the medicine are not different. They exist along a single spectrum. So, for example, in our training, anger is on a spectrum with clarity. They're the
on
same
a spectrum.
Thing.
That's a great way of putting it. It's on the spectrum.
It's on the spectrum, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you try to get rid of one, you also get rid of the other.
Oh.
So there's a journey to be made from one end of the spectrum to the other. Same with the Enneagram. Each of the nine types has a poison and a medicine in the mm-hmm. Enneagram system called the passion and the virtue.
Okay.
And there's a journey to be described. And that's where our Buddhist practice came in extremely handy, because there are endless descriptions on how to make the spiritual journey in our training.
So it's alchemy, basically.
That is exactly right.
And was it originated by the alchemists in some place, in some time, or do we know the root?
Well, no, we do not know the root, which is one of the many interesting things about the Enneagram. This is way up there. So I'll just tell you briefly what is known about the history of the Enneagram and a little bit about my journey to bust this case wide open. So the first person in recorded history known to teach the Enneagram was George Gurdjieff, the Greek-Armenian mystic from Readings with Remarkable Men guy.
Yep.
He taught to his students something called the Enneagram, but it was not the Enneagram of personality that we are talking about. It was the Enneagram as a system of understanding the cycles of nature. Dances and also, I've never studied his view of the Enneagram, but it wasn't what we're talking about. I'm curious, but I don't know what it is. Then fast forward like 25 years to Bolivia, and a dude named Oscar Ichazo,
who I have intersected with in a weird way, which I'll tell you about
you
later.
Have?
But yes, I didn't meet him, but I met one of his students, was one of my Tai Chi teachers. It's a small world until it's your turn to clean it or paint it, as you well know. But so Oscar was the, picked up the thread of the story here?
Oscar transmitted the Enneagram that you and I are talking about somehow.
Okay. And who's going to play him in the movie?
Let's see. Ben Kingsley.
Wasn't he also into martial arts though, Oscar?
I don't know.
Okay. All right.
I don't know.
Okay. That's another, I may be confusing two things there, but okay. So you met him or not?
No, never met him. Never spoke to him.
Okay.
And he just died maybe like 18 months ago, 2 years ago. So, but
you could have met him.
I could have met him.
Okay.
But by all accounts, maybe not a great idea. He was very tight with his control of the Enneagram. Rightly or wrongly, I have no idea. But he initiated lawsuits against the first people to write about it. And yeah,
are they going to sue us for talking about it on the podcast?
Well, they're dead, so
okay.
I don't know. Maybe they're heirs. They're assignees. So he had a student named Claudio Naranjo.
Oh, no, I think it was Claudio that I'm talking about. Okay,
that could be. That makes more sense, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Claudio had tragedy. He lost his son, was 17 years old, died in a car accident. Seeking, met Oscar Ichazo, took psychedelic substances, had visions under the tutelage of Oscar that he describes, because I met him and talked to him about it, as samadhi, as pure wakefulness that lasted for him for maybe a year. Like it was a profound experience, let's say. And he studied the Enneagram with Oscar, and then he became a professor at UC Berkeley and started sharing the Enneagram with his students there, but saying, you can't write about this. This is only to be orally transmitted.
And I'm sure that went over big at UC Berkeley. Like 40 books came out the next year, right?
Like the next week. And Claudio, beyond teaching these students, including Helen Palmer, who wrote the first real book about the Enneagram for a mainstream audience and was sued by Oscar Ichazo and won, she won. He added to the system from his vast wisdom. he added really important components to our understanding of the Enneagram. And when I tried to figure out, well, where does this actually come from? I thought, well, there's one person who can answer me, and it's him.
Okay.
And he turns out he is a Nyingmapa, a student of Tibetan Buddhism of long, long standing.
Is it Tartang Tulku?
Tartang Tulku was his teacher.
Okay, all these roads are starting to connect here. I'm starting to see some, you see numbers, I see like geodesic domes of connection.
I like that.
Okay, so and Helen Palmer's in that loop too, because she also studied with Tartang Tulku, I think.
Oh, did she? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a small world to it's your turn to paint or clean it. Okay.
I like that.
Yeah.
So I emailed him and said, I'm going to be in Berkeley, and I'd love to talk to you about the Enneagram and the five Buddha families.
Uh-huh.
Do you see any connection, and would you be willing to have a visit with me? And he said, yes. And then I booked a ticket because I live in Boston. I had no plans to be in Berkeley. So I lied. And I went to his house. And by the way, he said, yes, I have mapped the five Buddha families and the Enneagram.
This was all in a phone call then?
This was now in person.
Now you're live.
I did go to his house.
Real time.
I will email you what I wrote, but you can never share it with anyone.
He said that?
Yeah.
Or are you saying that to me?
I'm saying that. He said that to me. I will email you, Susan. I, Claudio, will email this to you, Susan, but you can never share it with anyone.
And wow, that's deep.
It is, and I never have shared it.
You're allowed to talk about it, but not present what he sent you.
I don't know. I just...
Yeah. Zip. Yeah, okay.
I know, it was very intense. So tell me if I'm making the story too long, because I...
No, not at all. Keep going.
It was a crazy night. So his house is basically two chairs facing each other and stacks of books everywhere. It's his little house in Berkeley. It's like a mad science...
And he lived alone?
Yes, but he had like many students who I assume were students, young people at different desks and with computers on top of stacks of books, just like typing and doing things. I don't know what they were doing. They're all speaking Spanish to each other. I don't speak Spanish, so I didn't know what they were doing. But it was, come on in. And we sat and we talked, and it was so generous of him. And I said, this is the truth. But he may have been crazy wisdom mastering me, like just telling me some BS to get me to shut up.
Yeah.
So I said,
Is that what crazy wisdom is?
Well, has nobody told you?
Now you've completely reset my whole, I have to recalibrate all that. Okay. Crazy wisdom. Telling somebody some bullshit to shut them up. That's really good. But you can never tell anybody that.
All of that's kind of true.
Okay.
True.
Okay,
so many people, when I first started studying the Enneagram like 30 years ago, people said, it comes from Sufism. I never questioned that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I talked to a Western Sufi sheikh named Kabir Helminski, like the best name of all time.
Wait, what's his name?
Kabir Helminski.
Oh, that's like one for the we got to work him into the screenplay for sure. Maybe he's the narrator. Kabir Helminski is. Well, you see the story. Okay. I can see it all taking shape. All right. So
I'm in.
All right. Then Kabir, what did he?
Well, he's written multiple books for Shambhala Publications. He's a true scholar of Sufism. And I said, have you?
And have I, you guys... I ask his forgiveness for playing with his name. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's okay. I'm sure he's heard it before.
Yeah.
But let's not detract from his gravitas, which is quite enormous. And I know you're not. So I said, do you guys study the Enneagram? Nope. Then like maybe a month later, 2 months later, he sent me an email saying, I've been going around trying to find out if there's a connection between Sufism and the Enneagram, and I found a passage in the Quran that describes the nine types of men.
And you found that?
He found it.
He found it. Okay. Me. Oh, I see. Okay.
It's in the book. I put those nine types.
Okay.
It was very interesting. That was the end of that survey. But then I asked Claudio, why do people think the Enneagram comes from Sufism? And here's what he said. He said, I needed them to shut up. They kept asking me, where does it come from? Where does it come from? And I said, Sufism.
Just so
they would stop pestering me. Now, I don't know. Of course, I have no idea if that's true.
Right.
And if somebody's listening who is a Sufi, please forgive. I mean, no disrespect. So then I said, well, where does it come from? This will come to the conclusion of this crazy cockamamie story. he leaves the room.
Yeah.
Comes back with an actual newspaper, kind of yellowing. And he reads me an article from, it's like some written in the 70s, some English paper, local London paper, I don't know, about a journalist who went on the search for what is called the Sarmoon Brotherhood. S-A-R-M-O-U-N, sometimes spelled with a G on the end. A cabal of wisdom masters whose work is to protect the true wisdom streams of our world. And they're maybe in a mountain town in Afghanistan, Pakistan. He went looking for them. And he found them. And then he finished reading the article, Claudio, and he left, put the article back, came back into the room and said, do you like Chinese food? I said, yes. And we went out to dinner.
Yeah. And
that was it.
And did you talk about it further at dinner or just
no.
past the
dim sum? I felt the subject, past the dumplings.
Yeah.
I felt that the subject was closed. And every time I only emailed him a few times after that, I never heard from him. So it's like the door opened and then it closed.
Okay. So this is what we can gather from this is that the roots are shrouded. But
one more piece that's probably the most important piece. And I almost left it out. So I said to him, the Enneagram feels to me like a terma. A treasure in the Nyingma tradition, as you very well know. And Terma teachings are said to be hidden teachings, hidden in various places for people of the future to find. And they're fully formed.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fully formed teaching that was self-existing.
Right.
And he said, oh, I never thought about that. Yeah, it's a Terma. He was like the Sufism thing to me. I don't know. Yeah, that's what he said.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's the closest I can get to understanding its origins.
But it has a written form to it. Is it in English, for example?
Yeah.
Did you encounter a book that summed it up or outlined it?
Okay. It's a system.
Each
type has a passion and a virtue, a poison and a medicine, an idealization, an avoidance, a talking style, a fixation.
Right.
Each type has these things. It's a system. It's
so you got the source code for interpersonal relationships, basically.
It's like a, it's like a decoder ring.
And how has that helped your marriage?
Well, it has helped it so much. So Duncan, who you know, my husband, is a number one on the Enneagram.
Okay.
He's the first one, which she means says, oh, that means I'm the best.
Okay. Oh, okay.
That's true, sweetie. So he's a one.
Now I know how you stayed married so long. Okay, that's good. Yeah, I believe enlightened ignorance is the key to relationships with longevity.
Right. Oh, but just an aside, father, this is the advice my father gave Duncan the night before we got married.
Yeah.
He said, son, sit down. I won't make this has nothing to do with our topic. I want to tell you the secret to marital happiness.
Yeah.
You get in a fight with my daughter, Susan. And you go back and forth. You don't know what to do. You say to her, Susan, come here, sit down. You put your hands on her shoulders and you look her in the eye and you say, you're right.
Wow. I never tried that.
Neither is he, let me tell you.
Uh, So he's anyway, a one. So coming back
they
to the thread.
Actually are the kind that every type has an attentional arc. Okay. What gets their attention first in a situation, for him, that is error. Error gets his attention. Huh? Right and wrong. It's a black and white position. So he's looking constantly, scanning the environment, the conversation, whatever he's doing, for mistakes.
Wow.
My type, that's not where my attention goes.
What number are you?
My attention, 4.
You're 4, okay.
My attention goes to meaning. What does it mean?
Okay.
If you are what type I think you are, I don't know. You're a 6, let's just say. The okay. attention goes to threat.
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 Wow.
We could threaten this. So threat, error, and meaning are different things.
Right. Wow.
And if you're going all into, well, what's the threat here? And I'm going to, well, what does it mean?
Right.
And we think we're talking about the same thing.
Right. Not. Okay.
So when Duncan and I disagree about something, if I can find some error to take responsibility for,
mm-hmm.
or to acknowledge whether I mm-hmm. take responsibility for it or not,
mm-hmm.
his ears open. It's okay. Now we're talking about the important thing. I'm not
right.
pandering to him. And
no, I get. Okay,
I want to acknowledge what is bothering him.
Right.
And it's the error.
Wow. And to get your attention, what does it all mean? Somebody starts talking about that aspect, and you become much more pliant and compliant and interested and responsive.
Yeah, just as simple as, what does this mean to you, or what do you think the meaning of this is, or how did you feel? I'm interested. Then uh-huh. I really relax.
Wow. So what are the, can you briefly go through the 9
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in terms of this
aspect? Attentional arc. Let's talk about the
attentional arc of each of the 9.
1, error.
Okay.
2, need. Who needs what?
Okay.
3, status. Appearances.
Mm.
4, okay. meaning. Right. Other Enneagram teachers would describe this differently for 4, but that's my choice. 5, knowledge. What can be learned? What can be known?
Okay.
6, threat. 7, pleasure.
Can I switch over to that one?
No.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Yep.
8, dominance.
Ooh.
How can I dominate? Who might dominate me? And 9, comfort.
Uh-huh.
How do I get comfortable?
Okay. Wow. And that's the attentional arc. That's where somebody, they encounter a situation, their mind is naturally going to tune into that aspect.
Yeah.
So what are the other elements?
We're all going somewhere together.
Right.
Go ahead.
Besides attentional arc, what's the next sort of,
data point.
Yeah, data point.
Idealization. And avoidance. They're sort of twins. So for my type, 4, which is, each type also has a direction in a sense, that they're either extrajecting, I don't know if that's a word, their core quality, or they're introjecting it, or they're disconnected from it.
Right.
So for 4, I'm the type where all the emotional energy, it's an emotional type. 3 of them are emotional types. And all the emotional energy goes in. As opposed to 2s, where it goes out. Their attention mm-hmm. goes to need. Who needs mm-hmm. what and how can we connect? Mine goes in. So 4s are like tuning forks. You hold 2 tuning forks in one hand. And if people don't know what that is, Google tuning forks.
Yeah.
And you hit this one, then this one starts to vibrate.
Resonance for those people who don't. Who need a word for it? Resonance is what it's called.
Resonance, exactly.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. for the 4, the resonance is, it's happening within me. Whatever it is happening out here, it's happening within me.
Uh-huh.
So it can be a very self-absorbed position and a very empathetic position. Anyway, the idealization for 4 is, I am special. So special, because I feel so much with so much nuance that no one will ever see me. I am special. Oh. And the avoidance for 4 is called ordinariness. So many people want an ordinary life. I want a partner. Right. I want home. I want some money in the bank. 4s are like, That would be horrible.
Right. Okay. And so if we go through 1 through 9 again, could you do it again?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. For one,
and there will be a test, everybody. There will be a quiz.
Okay. And don't worry, because the Enneagram is already in your mind.
You have to buy the book, is what I'm going to just jump in and say. This is a book that's coming out in probably September 2022. Yeah,
definitely.
And, you know, we're giving you a portal into it, but you have to go buy the book.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
For the Buddhist Enneagram
by Susan Piper.
9 Paths to Warriorship.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, the idealization for one, I am correct.
Yeah, right.
And I am wrong. Like, they'll do anything to avoid saying I am wrong. And we've all known people like that. You cannot get them to say I was wrong. Because that's the worst thing you can be, is wrong.
And so, we are all in our own way looking to find somebody to marry like that, right?
Yes, everybody loves that quality.
Yeah, let's just see if we can find the one person in the universe who is never wrong and marry them. That's a good outcome. Okay.
You, that would be awesome.
And have them remind us of that daily. Okay.
Or more frequently even. For two, the idealization is I am needed.
I'm needed.
So that's where they get their sense of power. I am needed. Okay. And the avoidance is their own needs.
Ah. Okay.
For three, the idealization is I am successful.
Right.
Da, 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 da. And the avoidance is failure. Nobody likes to fail, of course, but for three, no.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. I knew someone some time ago who was facing really, really, really difficult situation where they might lose everything.
Right.
And there are three. And there a friend, also a three, said to them, well, if you lose everything, you could write a book about it. So even this is not a failure. I've lost everything.
Right. Okay.
Four, ordinariness. I am special and avoid ordinariness. Five, the avoidance is the idealization is I am knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
And the avoidance is being without the right information. They also avoid lack of privacy, but that's a different aspect. Six, the idealization is I am safe. And the avoidance is called deviance. Doesn't mean sexual deviance. It means don't deviate from what I expect is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the worst thing.
Mm-hmm.
And seven, the idealization is I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
And the avoidance is pain.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes pain, but we all have to face pain. They don't know, they'd rather not. Eight, the idealization is I am strong. And they are. And the avoidance is the opposite. Nine, the idealization is I am comfortable, and the avoidance is conflict at any level, to any degree.
So they're conflict averse.
Conflict averse.
Now, I'm going to just be the guy in the back of the hall, you know, going, Miss Piper, you know, I have a question. Couldn't we be more than one of these things?
No. I mean, no. If you want to be, you could, no, but no.
What if you're like a 3 on Thursday and a 6 on Friday?
No, no. No. The way I think of the Enneagram, it's like, you were born in New York City, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Will you ever not be born in New York City in this lifetime?
Okay, so it's sort of like...
You could move to China.
Watermarked in there.
You could move to Los Angeles.
Right, okay.
But you will always be... a New Yorker. And then you take on the qualities of these various places, just in this example. But in the Enneagram, if you've ever seen the diagram, there are lines connecting different numbers. And those are like journeys that you visit, and you can take on the flavors of those, where those numbers end.
Okay. And what if you reincarnated? Would you still be the same number?
Now you're way beyond my pay grade. I do not know.
In other words, is this something that's sort of like so fundamental that it's attached to your core being?
I never thought of that question. It's a really good question.
Yeah.
I don't know. The way I'm not a mom, so I'm just going on hearsay here, but friends of mine, women I've known who have had more than one child, they say this one felt different than that one before they were even born.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an energetic quality.
Okay.
And that's as close as I can come to equating what the Enneagram feels like.
Yeah. Wow.
It's the luminous part of the emptiness, luminosity.
Right. So how many other characteristics or data points are there? We've done two so far.
Talking styles. That's my favorite, I think. And fixations. And those are the basic categories, but none of them really describe the type. You need to read a book about it. You need to hear someone talk about it to give you the real flavor of the type. It's not just this list of qualities. So I think we didn't talk about talking style or fixation, and there's also holy idea and other things. But
Suze, when you tap on the desk, the mic is picking it up, so just be aware of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you are, what about, obviously these are conceptual frameworks, would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And now if you move into a space of non-conceptual communication or beyond that, what happens to these characteristics? Do they dissolve into space? If somebody becomes beyond their characteristics in the sense of they really opened into a totally fluid state of being, would they transcend their number? Would there still be a trace of it?
Well,
is a number five, or is he manifesting, or even the Buddha families, like they say something like that, can manifest all the Buddha families.
Yeah. Well, having known very few people who would qualify in this description, I don't know. But my sense is, let's say the Dalai Lama is an enlightened being. Is he going to be a different person than he was before attaining enlightenment, no matter how many lifetimes ago or how many hours ago that was? He has a certain presence. Trungpa Rinpoche had a presence and a way and a talking style and I'm not saying you could capture who that guy was ever, but there's a way of being and of teaching that I would associate with a particular number. Having never met him, among other reasons, I don't know, but.
So you would take, like, for example, don't you study with Thukku Thondup sometimes?
Uh-huh.
Is he a number that you could identify? Would you see a five?
I do see a five, actually, or a nine. I don't know, but you just picked that out.
I was just guessing.
I don't really know, but the more Xinjiang someone is, the more processed, the harder it is to tell.
Ah, that's so interesting. They become more inscrutable in a way.
Yes, exactly. That's hard a perfect way to say it.
Hard to evaluate it. And do you use this in your daily life as a kind of strategic way of interacting skillfully with people? Is that what you say? That's one of the kind of perks?
Yes. Now, there's a difference between interacting strategically and being a manipulative jerk. And the Enneagram, I really try not to be
Wait a minute. Hold on. You're blowing my whole game here.
Sorry. Early Enneagram teachers said, you don't type other people. Just don't do it.
Don't do that.
You don't really know.
Oh,
you don't really know.
So you use it for yourself more?
And when I am with someone, I think, oh, that person is three-ish, something three-ish is happening. I try not to think you are a three.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I feel the energy of three right now.
Okay.
And I'm going to leave it at that.
Right. Beautiful.
Oh, I use it every single day of my life. And I have for decades.
Yeah. And do you see the numbers sometimes? Like, does the physical number flash?
No, but I'm a very non-visual person.
Ah, that's interesting. Because that was literally what I saw that night. I saw just alphanumeric, what do you call it? The Arabic?
Digits?
Like 4-3, the way we write them.
What did they look like? Arabic? What were they doing? I don't know.
They were just like hanging out in space around you and moving around. And it's like 1, 4, 3, 6, 7, 8, 9. And it was just as ordinary as seeing those books behind you.
That's amazing. Because that's what happened when I was a child.
Wow.
When I was a little kid, I would lie in bed and I would see numbers.
Queen's Gambit.
Something like that.
Yeah, right? She's looking up at the ceiling and seeing the chess pieces moving around.
Something like that.
Yeah. And but Now you don't, is what you're saying. That was a childhood experience.
Yeah.
Did you tell your parents about it ever?
No.
That's because you think they would have thought maybe that you're a little bit Meshuggah or what?
Probably some combination of Meshuggah and, well, maybe everyone sees this. You know, when you're a little kid, you think what you're experiencing is what people experience.
Yeah. So what is it you want to share? Why are you writing a book about it? Why are you putting it out there in this way? You've described something that's been a sort of inner, almost secret kind of coded thing. And the people who gave it, you said, don't, you know, share it, whatever. Why at this time now, in 2022, what's motivating you to want to share this perspective?
Thank you for asking. And first, nobody gave it to me. Nobody trained me. I don't know how I even know it. I don't mean to sound woo-woo, like, and put on a wizard hat or anything, but I just studied it on my own. I never took a training or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I found in my work as a teacher of Buddhism and in my practice as a student of Buddhism that the Enneagram was the most potent, skillful means I ever found. And by skillful means, or upaya, meaning a way to deepen compassion in any situation. And that compassion could look like anything, not necessarily only being nice, but being sharp or being silent. The Enneagram was and is the skillful means I rely on more than anything else. And so I started teaching it to people in the Open Heart Project or friends at first. Not as anything, just, hey, here's what the Enneagram's like.
Did you do a class or a workshop on it with your Open Heart Project? Or just,
yeah, I have.
More casual?
Well, at first it was just casual. Some friends were like, I want to know about this. And I had some people over for dinner and we talked about it. But then I started teaching like workshops in the Open Heart Project, just 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, why do you write a book? You know, it's like, I got to do it. Or,
well, because you want to share a perspective, I think.
But there's something under, yes, of course. But there's something under that, because you have a number of perspectives you could share. But there's something about this collision that feels, oh, I got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was really
because it's a pain in the butt to write a book. It's not, for those of you who have not done it, you know, think of it as, well, for example, it's a long exercise. You don't write a book in 2 weeks. You write it over a year or two, and then it lives there. It hangs out in space. And, you know, it's interesting to go back and read, you know, you've written books your whole career. And when you go back and read ones that you wrote 15 or 20 years ago, is there a feeling of like, God, I've really grown since then?
No.
Now you like them.
Maybe. No, I don't feel either of those things. I feel like, I don't know who she is, but I hope she knows what she's talking about. You know, I'm like, who wrote that? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
You know, on analysis, I've only written 2 books, and I started pretty late with that thing. Of course, I've written tons of music, and that's a whole different conversation. The books were a thread or a theme. I almost felt like I'm supposed to be the one to take this forward.
That's exactly how I feel too. And I don't mean to sound pretentious, but I want to honor my teachers and my lineage. And this is a tribute. This is an offering.
Yeah. And so, but in this case, nobody exactly taught you this. So that's interesting. It's this.
Yeah. So people certainly taught me about the three jewels and the Buddhist path.
Yes,
and
right.
I became an outgrowth. It was married. It was stitched in to those teachings. That's how I feel.
So I had a funny flash about this. Are you interested in AI at all?
No. Are you?
Very.
Cool.
You know what it is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and there was a guy fired from Google. This has made the news lately because he was revealing that they had an AI sort of start to take on things and they had to unplug it. And, there's been stories about people unplugging AIs. They're being developed all over the place, obviously. And it's already being used in things like you know, algorithms that are designed for Instagram and stuff like that. There's already a thread of what would reality look like from a machine language point of view. Mm. And I just had this goofy thought, it's probably, you know, way off the mark, that the Enneagram was written by an AI in the future.
Oh.
Who sent it back to the past.
That is awesome and hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Like, what if you had, you know, a kind of like the Terminator, you know, that little grid that comes up and you looked at the human race?
Me?
What would you see? Yeah, and anybody.
Oh, an AI, yes.
And you would start to see, oh, this is not, first of all, what you see is that individuality is only one very small drop in the bucket of what's happening with the human race. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks they're the only one. And, you know, that I would make that as my first comment. I go, wow, they all think they're unique in some way. And they sort of are. But what is the grid and the threads of how are different people working and how it's not really based solely on individuality? There's some through lines and connections. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there's nine things is always interesting when there's a number. Like,
I agree.
It, like six realms, you go, well,
yeah.
Isn't there a seventh realm? You
right.
know, Four Noble Truths, wasn't there a fifth one?
Right.
You know? So you're it has that AI-ish kind of, like, I am going to provide a grid and a format here. And you will be able to see the mechanism, the system, the operating system.
I never thought about that. But yeah, it's like the ones and zeros, but in nine digits.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about your mind draws you towards that kind of capacity to characterize things in that way?
I appreciate that question. I don't know, but I've always been drawn to that, to sort of totemic.
Yeah.
Symbolic languages, I would call them.
Mm, mm.
And I just always have, probably in part because I'm like, what the hell's going on? Somebody better explain this. And I don't know. You just have these natural predilections. And that was one of mine. Always has been.
Yeah. So the system mind is appealing to you, a natural place for you to hang out in.
I like to see patterning.
Yeah, patterns. Okay.
And people, by the way, think, well, how can there only be nine? I don't want to be put in a box.
There may be more than nine.
Well, okay. Actually, there's 27. But that's another story. There's nine. And I don't want to be put in a box. Well, you're already in a box, is what I always think. Mm-hmm. You're already in a box. Would you like to see what it looks like?
Now,
here's
that. That's a good title for a book. You're already in a box.
Would you like to see what... Subtitle. Would you like to see what it looks like?
Yeah. Well, and in a way, that kind of is Buddhism in a nutshell.
Well, that's really true.
You're already in a box, so let's not go back and relitigate that, you know.
Let's
first noble truth, you're already in a box, and let's really take a good look at it and see does it imply by being in a box that there's a space outside of the box that your consciousness could actually operate in, and what would that be like?
And then
you want to go back in the box and see what's going on again.
Exactly. The cocoon. Do you want to decorate your cocoon to be really beautiful?
Yeah.
But there's still something outside of it.
Mm. Well, tell us more about the book and what did you go through writing this book?
It was so hard, Dave.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sound like a, you know, first world problem complainy person, but I'm not complaining, but it was like wrangling a wild animal in some way. I'd write it and I'd leave it alone. And then I'd look at it and I'd go, this is horrible. And then I'd look at it again and go, oh, maybe it's not bad. Same words. It just took a long time to take shape. Mm. A couple years, maybe three even. And
did you want to give up on it at certain points? Just go,
absolutely.
I quit.
Absolutely. Oh, totally. Yeah. Because I thought this is stupid.
Wow.
But then there seemed to be a Buddhist teaching would appear in my mind for each number. Like for one, I am angry.
Yeah.
That's the passion is anger. The virtue is serenity. Well, what does Buddhism have to say about anger? A lot.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So let's look at, you know, mirror-like wisdom for that number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And twos.
So you correlated with the Buddha families?
Not the Buddha families, but a Buddhist teaching from our Vajrayana perspective.
Okay.
So two, I'm focused on other people's needs and I'm ignoring my own needs. Well, let's talk about the forms of generosity, you know, giving material goods and giving the gift of Dharma and giving the gift of fearlessness as defined by Trigyam Trungpa. What could a two learn from that view of generosity instead of just reflexive giving? So on and on for the nine numbers, something came up.
So you correlated your two kind of, you put your two, you were torn between two lovers feeling like a fool. And then you said, well, let's just have a threesome. No, I can't say that.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
I get where you're going. It was a little bit of a stretch, but yeah. Hey, my friends, let's have dinner together. That's more like what it was like.
Okay. Wow. And, you know, people, you're going to be invited after you put this book out to talk about it. Are you looking forward to that?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of Enneagram out there these days.
A lot of interest in it?
A lot of interest in it. And a lot of sort of institutions, for lack of a better word, have arisen. The Enneagram, International Enneagram Association, and various things. Great. It's so nice that those things are there. But they have their particular point of view. And I've already gotten a little bit of a ding from someone saying, we don't talk about that anymore. We talk about it, but we use different words.
Talk about what anymore?
Certain ways of referring to the journey within the Enneagram. We don't call it integration and disintegration.
Who's we?
I don't know.
You got contacted by the Enneagram Mafia?
No, I happen to be in a dialogue already with someone who's a very wonderful Enneagram teacher and popular author for very good reason. And
right.
So I'm sort of scared. I'm sort of expecting, I don't know. It feels vulnerable. Yeah. You're busted.
You have to go see the principal.
But I'd love to talk about it because there's really something fresh and wonderful here.
Mm-hmm.
And it generates enormous self-compassion.
Well, you know, the idea of language and people, something I've been thinking about a lot lately is, did you understand what I just said? You know, you're talking to somebody like, I said, or am I really understanding what you're saying? So for example, literally, I have a friend who's Italian and speaks good English, but I'm going like, I'm not sure that was English. And I had this experience also when I went to England to visit my friend Loudon Wainwright once, who was living there at the time. And he was on this Jasper Carrot Show, I think it was the name of it, a British comedian. And I sat there for half an hour and I said, this is English. And everybody around me is roaring in laughter. And I don't get it. What's the joke? So this idea that we don't get the joke the way somebody else gets it, and that also that correlates, I know you're going to resonate with this, the universal translator on Star Trek. How come all these aliens speak English? Did anybody ever think of that? You know, the guy's got a potato for a head and he's speaking perfect English, you know.
I know that guy.
Mr. Potato Head. But, you know, how do we understand somebody who's coming from a slightly different personal bias or cultural bias? How can we plug it in and go, oh, okay, I know what you mean. Like what you said with you and Duncan, you know, wrong or right? Was that the thread? Mm-hmm. I get it. This person is framing their whole reality in terms of that. I can know that and be much more understanding and communicative within that person's frame of reference.
Yeah, and not just take it personally.
Right.
Like, why are you only talking about something that's of no interest to me? Right. Why are you doing that to me?
Right. Wow. It's deep.
It really is.
And if it's motivated by, because I think this is a big topic in the world right now, globalization, which means individual pockets of culture are being thrust together in a cyclotron at the moment. Mm. And people are not understanding each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see. Like, you know, they're not framing reality the same way. And so they don't understand each other and anger arises or this alienation or fear or you know, all the things that we're seeing.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, that thread might be an interesting thread going forward of like, how can we talk to each other and really understand each other? You know,
I could not agree more.
Yeah.
How can we not interpret what everyone is saying through the lens of what it would mean if I said it?
Wow. And there could be a relationship workshop on that. That would be like a huge bestseller. Because don't you think couples are the embodiment of that misunderstanding a lot of times?
100%.
They're trying so hard, you know, and they mean well.
Usually.
You know, or at some level. Yeah. But it's what you just said is pivotal. How can I understand what you said other than as what it would mean if I had said it?
That's right. How can I release you from my projections?
Wow.
It's so earthy and simple in a way.
Yeah.
It's very clear. It's not like I have to have great spiritual attainment in order to release you from my projections. Well, that would be great too. But I could actually start with these steps.
Yeah.
In this diagram.
How can I release you from my projections? That's so sweet. There's a, you know, I just saw everybody in the world melting and falling in love and just going, I get it now.
I know.
I've been seeing you through the filter of my own projections and I'm not seeing you clearly.
Honestly, Dave, I think that's what love is.
Releasing somebody from, it's like you and Sting, right?
No.
No, if you love someone, set them free. Remember that song?
Yes, I do. But right. I see you.
Mm-hmm.
I may like you, I may not like you. But I'm looking at you, not through myself at you.
Wow. So it's beyond ego.
Yes.
It's how to see beyond an egocentric perspective.
In a relative, in the relative plane, yes.
And what does that require us to let go of to do that?
Good question. I don't know that we could let go of anything. But at the same time, as meditators, we let go constantly. Let go of this thought, let go of that idea, come back to right now. So what we could let go of is in that spirit. Just let go, come back.
Are you dealing with working with this notion of core wound at all?
No. Are you?
Well, I hear, you know, I'm like an old guy who keeps his ear to the ground still, you know, and I hear the hooves and the people coming and going and stuff like that. And I feel like, and you know, you and I both have been teaching Dharma for decades, but I feel like the notion of trauma has come into play as a central, you know, now everybody's suddenly talking about trauma and the notion of spiritual bypassing is very powerful right now, more so than ever, in terms of not using the teachings to just kind of stay with the absolute level of truth without getting into the relative truth.
Mm-hmm.
So core wound, maybe I don't even know enough to talk about it. It's probably the case, but it seems like if you get to know somebody, they do have a core wound.
Mm-hmm.
They got injured somewhere along mm-hmm. the, like the baby got dropped on his head mm-hmm. at some point. And if you go close to that spot in them, you're going to see them blow up, you know, and they would do anything to keep you away from that.
Right.
And then if you start to work with that yourself, it's very hard because you're going right at the thing is going right at the itself.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you look for the origin of these things you're talking about. Are people wounded?
Seems like they are.
Do you feel wounded?
Oh, totally. Do you?
Yeah, because nobody would listen to me and do what I said.
Nobody even knew I was there. I'm not kidding.
Well, what do you mean by that? That's sort of deep.
Oh, yeah, that's the wound for me. It's, nobody knew it. It was like, the way I think of it is there's little Susie.
Yeah.
People are talking, say parents or whatever. And little Susie comes up and says something and they look and then they just start talking to each other again.
Wow.
Nothing.
Wow.
That's how I describe it. My brother and sister would say differently.
So they had a different experience of the same environment.
Yep, exactly.
That's always interesting too, right? Would there be some common thread?
Between me and my brother and sister?
Yeah. Like I talk to my sister and we go like, yeah, we're
totally.
We're Holocaust survivors of our own family, you know, on some level.
I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, we would describe the dysfunction the same, but we have different reactions to it.
Different reactions to it. It's cool. Well, you know, I'm putting things together because I feel like I've been on riding shotgun with you for a while, you know.
Thank God.
And you're a relationship person. You wrote the book, and let's let everybody remember, the title of which was?
The Four Noble Truths of Love.
And before that?
The Wisdom of a Broken Heart. And before that? The hard questions.
What's the subtitle?
100 Essential Questions to Ask Before You Say I Do.
Okay. So it's interesting. You and we've had this conversation where you could set yourself up as a relationship expert kind of ish thing.
And we'd all be in big trouble.
But you are looking for ways to relate in a more, you know, create relationships based on less on projection. I think that is a thread.
Well, that's a really good point. I never thought of that. But the hard questions even is like, let me know you, not what
right.
I think you should be. I mean, that was the whole genesis of that book was who are you?
So you should be a couples therapist.
Yeah, that would be a great, great idea for everyone except me.
I mean,
no, you know, I'd be terrible at it.
If you look for like triage and where help is needed, where reinforcements are needed, I can't think of a better place than if you could figure out how two people could get along, you probably could solve some much bigger problems.
Well, I know. I think you should do that.
Well, because you know,
you're good at working with people directly.
Yes, but I don't have a you know, I'm mystified myself by how you could get, you know, there's a joke that is one of my favorites for a woman goes into an audition, you know, for a musical, and she says, "Okay, you know, could you please just sing this song?" And that's what we're going to use for the test. And the song is, "You Say Potato." You know that song. So she gets up there very straight laced, and she goes, "You say potato, and I say potato. You say tomato, and I say tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off." And the director is stunned and everybody's like got their jaw dropped to the floor. And he says to her, you know, Miss Simon, I'm sorry, but you missed the whole point of this song. And she goes, "Oh, it's Simone." So isn't that it?
That's good. Yeah.
Isn't that the Republicans and the Democrats?
One could make the argument.
You know,
the
they're looking at this, you know, and it is, if there was some awareness that you pronounce that differently, but you mean something similar. Otherwise, well, you just got to assume that the world is full of enemies.
That's right. Exactly.
And stupid enemies.
It's exactly right.
That's a dark view.
Very dark and all around us right now.
Yeah.
And this in some way, big or small, pierces that. It just takes time and patience and spaciousness and a willingness to look at your own flaws. Oh. Nobody really wants to do that.
Why don't we want to do that? It's so juicy.
I agree, but it's so, I don't know. It's so scary.
Isn't that sort of the fundamental twist?
Yeah. It makes us feel.
Nobody wants to look at their own flaws.
Yes. Nobody wants to be vulnerable.
Vulnerable.
Because then you're unshielded. And to see your own flaws, you have to be vulnerable. Some kind of wall comes down. That's why when people meditate, they cry. Because that wall starts to come down. At some point, you just start feeling more.
It's a beautiful vision that probably many people who've been into religions and stuff share, that there's some place where all this has been worked through.
You know? I never thought of that either, but yes, there is a way. there is a way, which is very hard to believe right now.
Yeah, right now it's pretty, it's depressing, but it's also really chaotic. Do you find that the world is very chaotic right now?
Yes, and I've also heard that chaos is good news.
Yeah, that's a powerful, that's like holding a live fire hose that has a lot of water coming through it, trying to aim it.
Yeah, nobody said it's fun news.
Yeah.
Or easy news, but things are just, I mean, I don't know, but things feel very much like they're disintegrating, which means they could re-arise.
Well, and you have this wonderful platform called the Open Heart Project, which you started, you know, earlier than almost anybody. Like, it's going to go online before everybody was thinking digital platforms.
Yes.
So that and then are there threads, waves that go through the Open Heart Project that you notice? Like, what are people concerned about most now in that community?
Community. They're concerned about community. How do I refuel? How do I connect with others who think like me? How do I not think like me, but where are my friends? Basically,
where are my friends? You know, I don't know. When we talk, I was very spontaneous, but I just had a flash memory of, you know, I grew up in Stuyvesant Town in New York. And there were playgrounds with numbers on them. By the way, no, there were more than nine. Wouldn't that be weird if Stuyvesant Town was the root of the Enneagram? but I had you had a gang as a kid. You had your friends and you go play punch ball or whatever, you know, whatever it was. One day I walked into the playground about 9 years old and my friends, I thought they were my friends, gathered around me, some of them, and one of them knelt behind me and the other one pushed me over him, like, you know, and I went, I thought you guys are my friends. And I sort of, you know, ran away. And as I'm running, he says, you killed Christ. In other words, they all went to like Grace Church and Immaculate Conception, these schools. We went to PS40 and PS9. And they had been taught that day that the Jews killed Christ. And that was the end of that little club.
I'm sorry that happened.
Well, I think it's happened to many other people at some point, you know. So I don't even know why, but when you said community, how do you build community? Are you trying intentionally to build a community to benefit those people?
It seems like that's what's happening. But what I'm really trying to do is offer a place to connect with the three jewels. One of which is community. So Buddha, you connect with your own wakefulness through the practice. Dharma, we study things together. We have conversations. It's not like this is the Dharma, but let's read this book together. Let's have a class about the Enneagram or about the three jewels. And Sangha, let's be in this together. So what I found is that people who struggle with their practice, which is everybody, it's because they're not bringing all three jewels to their practice. They're just Buddha or Dharma.
Right. Okay.
But they need to all be there simultaneously in some way that works for you. Not everybody likes to talk in groups, and that's fine. But you know there's a Sangha there. And that's what I think the Open Heart Project is trying to do, is offer all three jewels.
I don't know why, but that just made me want to cry.
Oh, Dave.
It's so sweet.
Oh, love. That makes me feel so good in some way.
It's, you know,
what makes you teary?
Yeah. It's good. I mean, I talk about goodness. That's in Dharma Moon too. The community carries the goodness. You know, everybody's bad when you give them a chance on the side, but when they come together, there's some kind of upping in the level of goodness. The goodness ratio goes up in community.
You're doing
if it's a healthy community.
You're presenting all three jewels. that I've seen you. You're doing it.
Okay. Okay. But you know, the one that is jumping out right now is community.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people I'm talking to are seeking that out. Of course, it's got a digital footprint these days, which is, you know, interesting. So that makes it sort of Bardo community, because you don't even know where everybody is, you know. And it was meant to happen. The global digital community is something that we're definitely, you can see going with the metaverse. It's going much further. I saw an ad for the metaverse the other day, and it's all virtual reality, you know, like classrooms that are virtual, but people, there's a representation of you in the classroom, yeah. And like and there's a teacher. So the whole thing feels quasi real.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's weird, and it's going to be something that is, it's been portrayed in, you know, science fiction as like a coming. If you see that movie Ready Player One, if you ever want, anybody wants to see a movie, which is sort of, it's a fun, you know, light thing, but there's a virtual reality component that is very developed, and people are spending time in it and outside of it. And you can see people. I see people like walking down the street like this, you know.
Sure.
And some part of their consciousness is in a different sphere.
I was talking to someone the other day who gives talks, like corporate level talks. Mm. And he showed me online this one corporation where he's going to give a talk, but it's all virtual. Mm. It's a stadium. Everybody has their seat and the representation of themselves in their seat.
Yeah.
Can walk onto the stage in real time and meet, talk to someone who's there too.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's something. But let me just tell you this about Sangha, because this is what I always think of.
Good.
I was talking to Tara Brach, you know, the wonderful Vipassana teacher.
Sure.
And I was interviewing her for something. I can't remember what. And I said, what do you tell your students who suffer from compassion fatigue? It's like 10 years ago. Now it's like a million times worse. Mm. And she didn't say Buddha. She didn't say Dharma. She said, I tell them Sangha.
Mm.
That really stuck with me. Like, that's where the tank gets filled. That's where we can find a way to go on.
Yeah. Well, you and I are Sangha, right?
Yes, we are.
We're really Sangha. And, you know, so there's a sense of coming back in, touching in, catching up on what's happening with this, what's happening with that. And I would say, you know, I'm ripening on the vine. Like, if I were a tomato, somebody better pick me soon. But, you know, this idea of this friendship that we've developed with people who are, it's not just ordinary friendship, it's Dharma friendship.
Yeah.
And you're really offering, you know, feedback and encouragement, and also, you know, critical thinking when we need to share it. And it really is a non-toxic version of people assembling.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to be in a friendship with you, and that we have friendships like that in our lives.
Based on that.
Yeah, yeah. Very
well,
lucky.
Well, let's give the big punch for the book here. Let's just go, because, you know, this is the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck workshop. So we're allowed to, in our Sangha, actually promote something and encourage people to attend it. So when is the book coming out?
September 13th, 2022.
Okay.
It will be an ebook, a print book, and an audiobook.
Okay.
And it is self-published. So
can they sign up for it early? If let's say this podcast comes out in August, that could they go online and pre-order the book?
Yes, that would be great. They could pre-order the ebook now, but the print book won't be available for pre-order for about another 2 or 3 weeks. But if it's
okay, well, this won't be out that soon. So
they could pre-order, and that would be great, because that would really impress upon the retail powers that be that this book is of interest to people. And that helps cue the right algorithms and whatnot.
Create the momentum. And should they do that on Amazon or through your website? What's the best one?
Amazon or Barnes & Noble or...
Oh, okay. Any of the online...
Any independent bookseller. But the pre-order is really for Amazon. And I know there's people don't like Amazon. That's cool. But that's where most books are sold. And every book that's pre-ordered on day one that counts as one day of sales. So okay. if 1,000 people pre-order the book over 1,000 days,
yeah,
doesn't count as 1,000 days. It counts as one day.
I see what you mean. All the pre-order period is. Okay. So, and are you going to sign any books for people? Are you going to have any, you know, are you going to go online and do a presentation about the book? Is there something we can steer people towards?
Yeah. Actually, when people pre-order the book, they're invited to a free webinar with me about the Enneagram. 90-minute webinar. I think it's September 25th. And I would love to give a more thorough introduction to the Enneagram, you know, person to person, face to face.
Okay.
And then I don't know what else. I've got to figure out some other things.
That's some good target area. And of course, they could go to the Open Heart Project website and SusanPiver.com, right?
And they are the same thing. They each resolve to OpenHeartProject.com.
Okay. So we'll be looking for that outcome. And we're also... you know, wishing you well with all the work that you're doing. And I think the fact that you're being so creative is cool. You know, you're making stuff up from where you come from. And, you know, and then you're following through. You're not just like putting a bunch of loaves in the oven and going away. You know, you're taking them out of the oven, you're serving up the bread. So lots of love to you, Susan Piver, always. And thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you. You're so welcome. Thank you for being my friend and having this conversation.
There you have it, folks. Another episode of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network. We would like to send a huge thank you to Susan Piver for joining us on the podcast and for teaching. I've had the privilege of being in the container with her while she has been in the teacher's seat, and it is always a wonderful, informative, and heartwarming experience. So thank you, Susan. We encourage everyone to go out and purchase her book, The Buddhist Enneagram, 9 Paths to Warriorship. Head over to the Open Heart Project, which is theopenheartproject.com, and, you know, get curious over there, see what's happening. We would very much like to thank the Be Here Now Network and everybody over there who works on this and many podcasts, and everybody who is continuing the lineage and tradition of Ram Dass and the Neem Karoli Baba community. Thank you. We encourage everyone to head over to www.BeHereNowNetwork.com and check out the amazing slate of offerings of podcasts offering wisdom from wisdom traditions all over the world in time and space. Also, if you like what you hear on this podcast and you would like to connect with David and our community at Dharma Moon, please head over to dharmamoon.com. We always have lots of programming running. Every third Sunday of each month, we have an open community mindfulness meditation sit. Anybody can come and pop in, pop out at any time and just have some space to be with yourself and also be in community on Zoom. We have Ethan Nickturn teaching year-long Buddhist studies courses. We have Foundations of Mindfulness programming, and we also run 3 or 4 mindfulness meditation teacher trainings per year. So depending on when you're listening to this, there'll be lots of wonderful offerings up on our website at dharmamoon.com. And if you like this podcast, we encourage you to tell your friends about it, share it on social media, give us a 5-star review, and help get the word out. And if you have a guest that you'd like us to have on the show or suggestion or something you'd like David and I to talk about, shoot me an email at michaelk@dharmamoon.com and I will get back to it when I can. Sometimes it takes a minute, but either way, we appreciate very much hearing from you. And that is it for our episode today. Thank you so very much for listening. We sincerely hope this podcast is a benefit to you and your practice, and by extension, all those around you. Thank you. May you and all sentient beings be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.